A pleasure to have another conversation with Mark Rubinstein, who writes the wonderful weekly newsletter Net Interest on financial sector themes. And Mark, I noted that you've just passed the 15,000 subscriber mark, so congratulations on that. This week, you write about financing recurring revenue. There's a lot of interesting work being done in that area by fintech companies in particular, but the concept is not entirely new, is it?
Yeah, exactly, John. So the financing opportunities for those with assets are enormous. Clearly, the asset-backed securities market is very much evolved. And there are lots of opportunities with companies with assets on their balance sheets to use those assets to raise finance. Increasingly, though, many companies' business models revolve more around intangible assets, and they can include customer relationships, for example, which don't feature on the balance sheet and which are therefore harder to finance. And so this week we have looked at the opportunities those companies have, and specifically the opportunity to finance recurring revenue streams, which are an increasing feature of the landscape for companies. But it's not a new innovation. So if we cast our minds back to the late 1990s, David Bowie, very successful musician, songwriter, he hit 50 years of age. He had a huge back catalogue of work, 25 albums he'd recorded since the late 1960s. And back in those days, it was before peer-to-peer file sharing. It was certainly before Spotify. His income predominantly, although he toured, his income predominantly flowed from album sales. And he did a deal in 1997. He sold his body of work to EMI, but retained 25% of the royalties. And what he wanted to do, in consultation with a banker called David Pullman, who apparently came up with the idea, was look for some way of securitizing those royalties that would flow when albums were sold, as they were, in a very recurring way, given how popular he was, every single day, over what they at the time carved out to be a 10-year period. So what they did is they carved out this 10-year period and they said basically, any album sales over the next 10 years will the royalties that flow from them will accumulate in a special purpose vehicle that will be used to pay a coupon to investors. And by constructing this structure and selling the royalty or selling a stream of coupons linked to those royalties to investors, Bowie was able to capture $55 million upfront. So he sold off his a part of his royalties for the next 10 years for $55 million of cash upfront. The counterparty was the Prudential Financial Insurance Company. They received a coupon, just less than 8%. And it was a very successful transaction. It wobbled a little bit in the early 2000s when peer-to-peer file sharing and piracy threatened to upturn the regularity of album sales. But there was enough kind of over-collateralization in that deal that didn't suffer a credit event. And it ran its course, and in 2007, it fully liquidated. It was fully paid off. So that was the story of the Bowie bonds.
Now, interestingly, it didn't really take off in a big way, that idea of financing, singer-songwriter catalogs. But there are examples of similar types of deals being done fairly recently with Planet Fitness and Sonic, the drive-in restaurant operator.
Precisely. So, as I said right up front, asset-backed securitization, very, very well-developed financial technology. Companies, though, that have got these recurring revenue streams, be they companies like Bowie, thought about as a corporate entity, and his royalty streams or companies like restaurant operators that attract a flow of franchise fees, or gym companies that take membership fees, or whatever it might be. They didn't have the same recourse to securitization. A solution did emerge, and it's called the whole business securitization. And that's very similar to a standard typical securitization, but instead of the assets being placed, instead of the financing being used to back specific well-defined assets, it's used to back the business in its entirety. And so a structure is created whereby all of the business's profits ultimately flow into this vehicle, which are used first to pay off the investors in that structure. And then clearly whatever's left over can be used for other corporate purposes. So not dissimilar from traditional debt, but slightly higher lien, and structured in such a way that all of the revenues flow through this vehicle, minus costs associated. Clearly, all of the earnings flow through this vehicle in a very similar way to a traditional securitization vehicle. But it works really only for those companies where there's a big degree of visibility over the recurrence of those revenues, the recurrence of those earnings. So hence the examples you give: Planet Fitness, big gym operator in North America. In 2018, they raised over $1.2 billion in cash against their membership fees. Ultimately, technically it was all of their earnings, but in reality, the recurring component was the membership fees. And then restaurant operators too. So Sonic, which is a fast food drive-in restaurant operator, they raised just close to $1 billion in 2020, backed by the franchise fees from their restaurants. So not too dissimilar to the Bowie bond concept of companies securitizing stable, predictable, visible, recurring revenue streams.
Another more traditional example was Gymboree, Playground, and Music. But what I find interesting in more recent years is that merchant cash advances have really taken off as part of this so-called API economy, where potential creditors can get much closer to companies' data. And Shopify notably launched a merchant advance cash product in 2016.
Exactly. So the merchant cash advance product it's very, very different from a securitization tailored towards small companies. And traditionally, it was advanced by merchant acquirers with the best positions, because in the offline world, they were the ones that had their software and hardware ultimately installed at the point of sale. And the merchant cash advance would work in such a way that a loan, technically it's not classified as a loan, but for all intents and purposes, it looks like a loan. So a loan would be advanced to the small merchant, and it would be paid back, unlike a traditional loan, which is paid back over a specified term and with an associated interest rate. This would be paid back on an unspecified term, and not through an interest rate, but through a discount. And the reason why it would be an unspecified term, basically a slug of, let's say, 5% of the merchant's revenues would be deducted at source every month until it was paid down. And rather than an interest rate, a fee would be, or discount would be attached up front. And this, again, it works, again, you know, I talk about it in the context of recurring revenues, because it works best for a company that has recurring revenues, such that the lender can underwrite knowing that 5% every month is going to be a kind of stable amount, and then be able to approximate a term based on that. So merchant cash advances took off. Initially, they were advanced by merchant acquirers, or at least distributed by merchant acquirers in the offline world. Increasingly though, and we've seen clearly there's been a huge step change in online commerce in the past year since the outbreak of COVID. And as part of that, we've seen an increase in these kinds of solutions in the online world as well. And you mentioned the API economy, John, and that's very, very important here, because it allows other companies, not the merchant acquirer sitting at the point of sale, but others to insert themselves in the process, given that to a degree like never before, they now have access to all of that company's internal processes. So they can plug into the accounting software, they can plug into the payment processes, they can see the storefront in an online context, they can, all parts of the business they can plug straight into through APIs, and that's that's a way in which outsiders, startups, are able to penetrate this market, which traditionally has been dominated, controlled, given their stranglehold on distribution by merchant acquirers.
Well, one very apt concept as this space advances and innovates is this notion of the single revenue contract as sort of the atomic unit of the subscription economy, and then trying to build businesses around that atomic unit, if you will.
Yeah, it's interesting. So this idea came from Alex Danko, who writes a very good newsletter every Sunday. And he has a view that the revenue contract, the individual revenue contract, is the atomic unit of the subscription economy, of recurring revenue streams. And certainly the analytical rigor around cohort type analysis, unit economics, is becoming much more prominent and much more relevant to a broader group of companies. So it kind of fits from that perspective. We're analysis, bottom-up analysis, and this kind of top-down concept of the revenue contract as the atomic unit, a meeting. And that's been going on for some time anyway, from an analytical perspective, but there hasn't been a way to finance that directly up until recently. And recently there have been a number of innovations in financial technology to do just that, to allow companies to sell their revenue contracts to third parties. And what's interesting about this is that it's not necessarily a true sale in the sense that they're selling the customer relationship. If you think about the customer relationship as a bundle of different features, those features might include the initial data that the customer provides. You know, there are ways to monetize that through sales via lead generation, and then there's the attention of the customer, and then there's the reduction of future customer acquisition costs if it was possible, for example, to reactivate a customer that goes dormant. And then, of course, there are the cash flows over the life of that customer until they churn. And the revenue contract defined here is simply, you know, 12 months of a single customer's revenues. And the ability now, through these APIs and through the innovations that have been created around financial technology, allows companies to sell off, just without selling off the whole customer, sell off 12 months of revenues. And that can be a hugely valuable way for them to raise finance.
Well, at the moment, I think a lot of companies that don't take advantage of the financing, but just do it themselves. Basically, if they have monthly recurring revenue, they typically also offer an annual plan that's basically pay for 10 months and get 12. But you point out that there's a cost to doing that. And one of the companies that seems to be attacking that space is the startup Pipe.
Yeah, that's right. It's an interesting startup. It launched only in February of 2020 into the teeth of the pandemic, and has raised considerable capital over the course of the past 12 months. And that's exactly the case. So they identified, as many other companies in the space did, a arbitrage opportunity. As you say, that companies were willing to give an annual subscription for the price of 10 months. So in giving away 12 months of service for the price of 10 months, they were effectively offering a 17% discount. And if you think about that as a financing discount, as a like a merchant cash discount almost, it's very, very steep. So the arbitrage opportunity is that actually there might be buyers in the market. So Piper is a bit different from other companies in the space because it's establishing itself as a trading platform. Its ambitious target is to create an asset class of revenue contracts such that people are prepared to buy 12 months of cash flow at something lower than a 17% discount, but enough for them to get a quite nice return, particularly given the zero rate environment we find ourselves in. So that's the business model of Pipe.
And it's kind of a reverse buy now, pay later, where you have firms like Klarna and Affirm.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So those companies are, they sit at the point of sale of merchants. And they do the reverse, as you suggest. They do the reverse, that they turn around to customers and say, why pay everything up front? Why not split it into installments? And companies like Pipe are doing the reverse, and they're saying, rather than paying in installments, they're saying this to the company, not to the customer, they're saying to the company, rather than getting your payments in installments, why not get them up front? Which has, so two ways of looking at a similar problem from reverse perspectives. And actually what's interesting is they're two of the fastest growing areas of fintech right now.
Well, you really get to the crux of the issue for a company like Pipe that's trying to build a marketplace, is this need to balance the supply and demand sides. And you cite historically back in the 1970s when KKR managed to basically create a new asset class with leveraged loans, that they proved adept at doing just that.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So what's different, as I said earlier about Pipe, is they're looking to establish a trading platform. I think it's very, very clear that the demand from companies to use structures and financing solutions to lower that discount from the 17% is very credible, and that's there. The question in launching a trading platform is this idea of balancing supply and demand. So we've established that the demand might be there, that there are many companies that will be looking to exploit this opportunity from that side. But what about from the other side, from the investor side? Well, there are low interest rates, so there might be some demand from investors. But clearly, as we know, in markets, different investors have different mandates, and this might be an esoteric asset class that isn't considered core to the mandate of many. But there's been suggestions that there are others who might enter the market. So, for example, platform companies, a company like Shopify. So Alex Danko, who I mentioned earlier, wrote an essay in which he puts forward this argument that a company like Shopify might, in order to support its own customers, might. So traditionally, clearly, there have been ecosystems around suppliers helping their customers through vendor financing, all sorts of solutions. His take on the solution in the platform economy is that these platforms might buy the revenue contracts of some of their customers in order to help fund their customers' marketing spend to grow further. So this symbiotic relationship is created where company sits on the platform, in this case Shopify. Shopify buys its revenue contracts as a way to help finance that company and foster its growth to the benefit of both. It's very interesting. If that demand does emerge, then this asset class could grow. But it's something we haven't, we've seen similar examples in other asset classes elsewhere, that a new source of demand has come in to kickstart the growth in that asset class. But it's very, very early days here. This company was only launched in February of 2000, raised another 50 million in a raise recently. But that'll be a very interesting development to watch.
What they've done well, I guess, copied a little bit the playbook of intercontinental exchange and market access, is to actually try to get some of their strategic investors on board as participants in the platform.
Precisely, precisely. When I've looked, exactly. When I've looked at, so when I've looked through history at successful, or, well, I was going to say successful fintechs, but broadly, more broad than that, successful new financial companies that have been able to emerge, then there are some ingredients. One of them often is some regulatory change. That's not really the case here. But a second one is that they get their customers as shareholders. So there's an alignment in the initial growth of those companies. So, I mean, Bloomberg's another example. Actually, Bloomberg's shareholder was Merrill Lynch, and was also his first customer. ICE took investment in 2000 when it launched as an energy trading platform from both Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. Market Access in fixed income trading took investment from JP Morgan. So, and right now, Pipe, this company we've spoken about, has taken investment from Shopify and a bunch of other strategic investors rather than venture capital investors, partly to help it grow its ecosystem.
Well, Mark, as you point out, fintech really works best when it takes the both finance and technology and harnesses those features to improve efficiency. And it seems like this is an area to watch in that regard. So thank you so much for bringing it to our attention and taking a closer look at it.
Thanks, John.
Goodbye for now.
Thanks.